This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED. Today on the EMDocs.net podcast, we're covering a couple of topics that have more of a preventative medicine type flavor. But before you stop listening, these are really important topics. If we catch these diagnoses that we're going to be talking about, we can have a big impact in the lives of our patients. Our first topic is going to be looking at new onset hyperglycemia in adult patients. The second topic is going to be on diagnosing skin cancers in the ED. Let's get started with hyperglycemia. We all know how to take care of that patient with DKA or HHS. While these are the emergent conditions that absolutely must be taken care of, hyperglycemia in ED patients is frequently unrecognized, untreated, or it's not communicated to a patient's primary care physician. So we might be missing an opportunity to have a significant impact in the lives of our patients because early diagnosis and treatment of diabetes decreases long-term morbidity and improves patient outcomes. In just 2018, over 20% of all U.S. adults who met the laboratory criteria for diabetes were not aware that they actually had diabetes. Let's be honest, when was the last ED shift that you worked where you didn't have a patient who was hyperglycemic? We see this on a very routine basis. While screening for diabetes is not routine in the ED, we do perform random glucose levels. Our first question when it comes to a patient with hyperglycemia is, does this hyperglycemic patient have a new diagnosis of diabetes? These patients will frequently present with polyuria, polydipsia, weight loss, and vision changes because of that hyperglycemia. We need to perform three separate assessments for these patients. First, we need to look for any hyperglycemic emergency like DKA or HHS. Second, you need to look for the etiology for the hyperglycemia. Look for things like infection, ischemia, medications, cancer, and even pregnancy. Finally, is trying to differentiate insulin-dependent diabetes versus non-insulin-dependent diabetes. This is previously known as type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Key elements of this history include the duration of symptoms, personal or family history of diabetes, or autoimmune disorders. A recent history of marked weight loss or other severe symptoms in a short period of time should raise your suspicion for type 1 diabetes. On your exam, you're looking for a normal or thin body habitus that raises your suspicion for type 1 diabetes. If they're hyperglycemic, many of these patients will present with dehydration, so they might have dry mucous membranes and tachycardia. Tachypnea is suggestive of acidosis and DKA, and then also look for signs of pulmonary infection. On your neurologic examination, if they're altered, that's suggestive of HHS. Decreased sensation in the distal extremities indicates neuropathy that's secondary to chronic hyperglycemia. Finally, on your skin exam, you might find acanthosis nigricans. You're going to be looking for signs of infection, wounds on the feet, and also decreased skin turgor. Now we're going to get to the heart of this part of the podcast. We're going to be looking at the laboratory evaluation. Most patients with type 2 diabetes will present without symptoms, and their hyperglycemia will just be an incidental finding. If they're symptomatic, you need to think about those diabetic emergencies. Obtain a point-of-care glucose, that basic metabolic panel, a CBC urinalysis, a pregnancy test for women of childbearing age, a venous blood gas, and a beta-hydroxybutyrate if it's available. If you're concerned about HHS, also tack on a serum osmolality. A new diagnosis of diabetes can be made in the ED using the ADA criteria. These criteria include a random plasma glucose of 200 or greater and classic symptoms of hyperglycemia or hyperglycemic crisis. If this is not present, you need two of the following abnormal test results. The first is a fasting plasma glucose of 126 milligrams per deciliter or greater. The second is a 2-hour plasma glucose of 200 or greater during an oral glucose tolerance test, which we're not going to be performing in the ED. The final is an A1C of 6.5% or greater. Again, two of those tests means the patient can be diagnosed as diabetes. If you have that patient who has a random plasma glucose of over 200 and they have classic symptoms of hyperglycemia or a hyperglycemic crisis, you have diabetes. Once you've excluded those hyperglycemic emergencies, the next step is just to distinguish the type of diabetes, and this is the tricky part. Patients with type 1 or autoimmune-mediated diabetes are at higher risk for poor short-term outcomes. While we classically think of type 1 diabetes as that disease of adolescence, over 40% of patients with type 1 diabetes are diagnosed after the age of 30. You need to think about type 1 diabetes in patients with significant weight loss, ketoneuria. They typically present with weeks or days of symptoms, a much more acute onset. The severity of symptoms is usually severe. They may have a family history of autoimmune disease or insulin dependence at a young age. And again, the age is typically preschool and teenage years, but it can present at any age. Type 2 diabetes usually doesn't have weight loss. They also won't typically have ketoneuria unless the patient has been fasting. The time course for symptoms is months to years. The severity of symptoms can be variable, but it's not usually severe. A family history is positive for type 2 diabetes in a significant proportion of patients. And finally, these patients typically present after the age of 40, but it can present in younger patients. The recommendations for treatment to specifically address uncomplicated hyperglycemia in the ED are very limited. We vary greatly in our thresholds for hyperglycemia management and our comfort with initiation of outpatient treatment. There is evidence to suggest that discharge with elevated glucose does not result in short-term adverse events. The key thing is that insulin is not needed in all patients whom you're suspecting type 2 diabetes. The most important component is establishing rapid follow-up with a physician who can coordinate that diabetes education and provide the needed outpatient therapy. Lining up this follow-up is absolutely essential. If you're able to, call the primary care doctor. They may want you to start a therapy like metformin in suspected type 2 diabetes. Of course, you have to think about the patient's social situation. For patients with severe elevations and it's questionable whether they can have follow-up, you might need to think about admission. If you are going to give the patient rapid-acting insulin, just remember that it's only going to drop the blood glucose for several hours without other therapies, and then the patient's right back where they started. Finally, let's talk a little bit about disposition. If you have that patient with suspected or confirmed type 1 diabetes, you need to think about admission to the hospital for further evaluation or even an ED endocrinology consult for assistance with discharge planning. This second group of patients are those who are hyperglycemic and they have a clinical picture consistent with undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. Patients who are asymptomatic and they have incidental hyperglycemia won't meet the ADA criteria for the diagnosis of diabetes. However, these patients are very likely to be diagnosed with diabetes on confirmatory testing, and they need to follow up with their primary care doctor for further evaluation. If you have a symptomatic patient and their blood glucose is 200 or over, then they meet the ADA criteria for the diagnosis of diabetes. At the time of discharge, think about starting metformin 500 milligrams once a day with a plan to increase twice daily in 1 week. Again, this should be discussed with a primary care doctor if available. Metformin is usually well tolerated with very minimal side effects, especially if it's taken with meals. It is contraindicated in patients who have impaired renal function or a GFR of less than 30. It's also contraindicated in patients with liver disease, active alcohol abuse, and patients with unstable heart failure. If you do end up providing a prescription for these patients, they're going to need close follow-up with endocrinology or their primary care physician. Finally, the disposition of patients with severe hyperglycemia or those with a blood glucose of 300 or more varies widely based on your practice environment and the patient characteristics. After the initial resuscitation and ruling out hyperglycemic emergencies and the underlying cause, these patients are often stable for discharge. Most published guidelines focus on initiation of treatment in the outpatient setting, but they fail to address the management of severely hyperglycemic patients in the ED who are otherwise stable and are going to be discharged. There's really no consensus on initiation of anti-diabetic medications for patients with severe hyperglycemia in the ED setting. Patients with new-onset severe hyperglycemia, they have an unstable social situation, or they have no access to follow-up, should really be admitted for initiation of therapy. If you work in a well-resourced setting, you can obtain close follow-up, and you have the availability of diabetic education, these patients might be able to be discharged home from the ED. All right, that's enough on diabetes. Let's move to our second topic, which is skin cancers. Skin conditions are incredibly common. In 2013, 1 in 4 Americans were seen by a physician for at least one skin disease, and approximately 3.3% of ED visits are for some skin condition. When we're thinking about skin cancer, there are several important questions we need to ask the patient. First is whether they have a personal or family history of skin cancer. Second, we need to ask about use of tanning beds, excessive sun exposure, or sunburns. Next, we need to ask about the chronicity, as well as the changes to that lesion. Finally, we need to determine whether they're immunocompromised. Our first skin cancer we're going to talk about is melanoma. This is the most concerning skin cancer and the fifth most common cancer in the U.S. There are several prediction rules that we can use to evaluate a possible melanoma. The first one is the ABCDE criteria. This stands for asymmetry, border irregularity, color variation, diameter over 6 millimeters, and evolving. The second is the ugly duckling sign. This is helpful in patients with multiple skin moles. It basically is a mole that looks different from all the others. Final one is the Glasgow 7-point checklist. One major and at least three minor features warrant a referral for further evaluation. Major features are a change in the size of lesion, irregular pigmentation, and an irregular border. Minor features are inflammation, pruritus or altered sensation, larger than other lesions, and finally, oozing or crusting of the lesion. While these are the classic presentations that we think of for melanoma, there are some atypical presentations. The most important one is a subungual melanoma. You can use something called the ABCDEF rule. This stands for age of 5th to 7th decade of life, African American, Asian, and Native American. B is brown or black band with breadth of over 3 millimeters. C is change in nail band. D is digit most commonly involved, which is the thumb and great toe. E is extension of pigment onto nail fold, known as Hutchinson sign. And F is family or personal history. For melanoma in children, you need to look for amelanotic, bleeding or bump, color uniformity, and de novo or any diameter. This is the ABCD criteria. Keep in mind that melanomas can metastasize, with the most common site of regional metastasis being the surrounding skin or tissue and lymph nodes. The most common sites of distant metastases are the skin, lung, brain, liver, bone, and the GI system. Lung mets are often the first clinically detected, with the bone and GI system occurring later in the disease process. When we diagnose this at an early stage, surgical excision can be curative and we can save the patient's life. When you're thinking melanoma and the patient is stable to go home, the most important step for us in the ED is to refer the patient for urgent follow-up with a dermatologist to facilitate biopsy of that lesion. The second skin cancer is basal cell carcinoma. This is overall the most common type of skin cancer. While it does have a low metastatic potential, it can be locally aggressive. It most commonly develops on the sun or UV-exposed parts of the body like the face and trunk. Nodular basal cell carcinoma is typically this pearly pink or flesh-colored papule. There may be some associated telangiectasias and a rolled border where the sides are raised higher than the center of the lesion. They can also ulcerate or bleed. Superficial basal cell carcinoma is more commonly found in younger adults. These lesions present as scaly macules or plaques with irregular or rolled borders. Diagnosis is confirmed with biopsy and complete excision is curative. If you have a patient with basal cell carcinoma concern, then refer them to dermatology. The third skin cancer that we're going to talk about is squamous cell carcinoma. Squamous cell carcinoma is composed of keratinocytes and commonly occurs in sun-exposed areas on fair-skinned patients. In darker-skinned patients, squamous cell carcinoma commonly occurs in non-sun-exposed areas like scars, the lower legs, and even the genital region. The cutaneous form often appears as a scaly or crusted lesion that grows over time and it may ulcerate and become painful. Concerning features for squamous cell carcinoma with a high risk of recurrence and metastasis include lesions that are greater than 2 centimeters, those in the elderly or immunocompromised patients, and those located on the face, the lips, hands, feet, or genitalia. Similar to our other skin cancers, diagnosis is confirmed with biopsy, so refer these patients to the dermatologist. Our final skin cancer is Merkel cell carcinoma. This is rare and it's highly aggressive with a mortality rate of approximately 33% at 3 years. We have one more set of criteria for you. These are the AEIOU criteria. A is asymptomatic and lack of tenderness. E is expanding. I is immune suppression. O is older than 50 years. And U is ultraviolet exposed site on a patient with fair skin. Lesions are usually irregular red nodules that are solitary, and they grow extremely rapidly. They may look like basal cell carcinoma, but they grow at a much faster rate. Treatment includes excision with or without radiotherapy. So again, if you're concerned, get in touch with your dermatologist. All right, we covered a lot of content in today's podcast. We looked at hyperglycemia and skin cancers. Remember, consider type 1 diabetes in adult patients with hyperglycemia and severe weight loss, polyuria, or polydipsia. These patients should have an ED endocrinology consult or hospital admission. For hyperglycemic patients who are stable without concern for type 1 diabetes, if they're asymptomatic and they have a random blood glucose of 126 or greater, outpatient follow-up for diabetes screening is appropriate. If they're symptomatic and have a blood glucose between 200 and 300, then you can consider starting metformin 500 mg once a day. For patients with severe hyperglycemia over 300 mg per deciliter, the patient is likely going to require long-term insulin therapy. Disposition of these patients is going to vary based on your practice environment. There's really no consensus on initiation of anti-diabetic medications for patients with severe hyperglycemia in the ED setting. The second part of our podcast looked at skin cancers. The key aspect is just being on the lookout for these skin cancers. Keep in mind melanoma, basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and Merkel cell carcinoma. If you suspect one of these skin cancers could be present, then arrange outpatient follow-up with dermatology. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.